The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
9:26 this Friday morning, text 51551. It's not too late to help save a family, by the way, from poverty this Christmas. And I don't say that lightly. We've been supporting the St. Vincent de Paul annual appeal, as always. It's just close to my heart, as you probably know, because it's practical. The money goes, you go online, it's very easy to donate, svp.ie. And wherever you are in the country, the money will land locally and it'll just get people out of a corner. A dark corner. And then very often those same people that come out of that corner will then go back into the daylight and donate themselves. And so you have this cycle of kindness. And we're joined in studio today by Yvonne, who credits SVP for helping her through college and beyond when she didn't have a whole heap herself. Yvonne, you're welcome. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Not easy for someone to come in and tell this story, so I appreciate it very much. But I also think it's really important because there are people listening today who are in the horrors and they haven't been.
Yeah.
And Christmas is heavy. And every magazine they look at and TV show they see is happy, 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 happy. And they're not. Give us a bit about yourself, if you wouldn't mind. You grew up where and how was it?
I grew up in Ballymun, and I'm the eldest child of four children, three younger brothers. And years ago in the 80s, my own family would have struggled with poverty and mental health and addiction.
Yeah.
So there wasn't much in our house. And likewise, my mother would have torn to St. Vincent de Paul back then. And I have memories of, going into town, into Osnam House, and picking up vouchers for shoes for them going back to school, and, you know, toys for Christmas, and, you know, all of that kind of thing. And
you were sent in to do the collecting.
Yeah, I was sent in to, with these dockets you used to get years ago, and you go into Osnam House and they'd have, like, you know, shoes and that you needed for going back to school, and you know, just Christmas help as well, like, for the children. So yeah, that would be my earliest memories of St. Vincent de Paul.
You talk about addiction in the house. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How much can you say? I don't want to press you unnecessarily, but just to get a sense of what you were coming from.
Yes, I suppose at times my parents, struggled with addiction, and it would have brought a lot of pressure onto me being the eldest child then, with them not being able to work, having to leave school early and go out and work and, you know, contribute to the family and, you know, and at times take over the looking after the children.
What age were you when you left school?
I was 13.
And can I ask you why you left school?
To support the family.
Who were you supporting?
Supporting my mother and my younger siblings.
And what do you do work-wise at that age?
At that age, my first job was in the local Chinese, you know, taking orders. And
Get away.
And I used to do that, you know, 3 or 4 nights a week.
And so school was off the agenda at that stage.
It was off the agenda at that stage.
It always fascinates me how, even though you didn't have education like school, you had absolute smarts.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You don't have to be in university to be a clever person.
No.
But you must have known that even when you were in the Chinese answering calls.
Yeah.
Like, I am better than this. Yeah. I know more than this. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, it would have been at that
stage.
So
were you reading, or what were you doing to kind of explore that?
Academically, no, I wasn't. I always had a big interest in going back to school, but I just never had the opportunity. Yeah. I then moved into the care system shortly after that then, and I was there until I was 18.
Okay. Tell me about your mother.
My mother, she was a great woman. And,
was she?
You know, in hindsight, she done the best with what she had. You know, it was tough. It was really tough. We had some really tough times in the house growing up. You know, she was in an abusive relationship with her husband, and, you know, the kids felt that, you know, a lot of times.
And they can hear things?
They can hear things, arguments, you know. Yeah, there was a lot of upheaval and moving around. And yeah, so it was tough.
How did she die?
Unfortunately, herself and my youngest brother died in a house fire in 1996.
How old was she?
She was 38.
And your brother?
And he was almost 3.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I know. It was tragic.
And were you in the care system at that point?
I was, yeah. I was in the care system. Yeah.
Would it be a stretch to say that might have saved your life?
Yeah, absolutely.
It'd be true?
Yeah, to be true, yeah. Yeah.
To lose your mother like that, you were what age?
18.
18?
Yeah, Yeah.
It doesn't matter what age you are when you lose your mother, but no. And your little brother.
And
well.
Little brother. Tragic. Absolutely.
Tell me about
tragedy.
That time. How did you cope?
Myself then, the only way I knew how to cope was through alcohol. So I got into my own addiction problems then. Yeah. And, you know, I had a baby very young myself then, a year after my mum passed. I found it very difficult. I was in poverty myself.
What does that mean, in poverty?
I was, you know, I had a baby and I was living on lone parents, and it was just me and the baby in a one bedroom flat at 19 years of age, after just suffering this huge tragedy in our lives and having to look after my two younger brothers as well at times, because their father wasn't coping very well. He had turned to drink also.
Do you remember Christmas at these times of honour?
Yeah.
How do you characterise the Christmases at that time?
You just done the best with what you had. You know, you relied on your friends, and you know, you relied on, you know, I always had a sense of work ethic, so I always worked part time, even if that's all I could do. So yeah, Christmases would be very. They wouldn't be as extravagant as some Christmases are today. Like, you know, we just get by.
Just briefly touching on domestic violence, I'm kind of quite horrified by some of the figures I've been reading in the last couple of weeks about domestic violence and stories you see in the newspapers about, I think I've read one statistic, somebody was saying that more women have died at the hands of partners in this country than have died in the criminal feud in the certain parts of the city. That's like a slaughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, what to do about that? I mean, what can we do to? We obviously can't stamp it out, but
no.
If you know somebody in an abusive relationship, what's the best way of dealing with them or encouraging them out of it?
Encouraging them out of it. I don't know. I suppose, like, for me, my way out of things was, you know, definitely talking to people, as much as I felt a lot of shame in asking for help, because that's the way I would have been brought up, you know, tell nobody nothing, you know, don't go out there and ask people for anything, you know, get it on your own. And, you know, just there's certain times in your life where you can't rely on yourself, you know, and you do have to go out there and, you know, you know, just access whatever community supports there is out there for yourself.
The Vincent and Paul always say that please don't, please try and write the word shame out of your lives immediately.
Yeah.
Because there is no shame in receiving, we always say it, a hand up and not a hand out.
Yeah.
And very often you can give the hand back.
Yes.
You know, that's important to know too.
It is.
And I mean, like the fact that you as a kid went out with your dockets to get the shoes, but that meant you had shoes on your feet to go to school.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, the shame is really, I suppose, some could say on the system in some ways, but also there should be no shame in a child impoverished.
No, I know. But, you know, other kids could be cruel. And, you know, I think that they nearly, you know, would be able to tell at times where you got your shoes from, and, you know, they'd be slagging each other and all in school and stuff. So it was, I think at that stage, even you felt the embarrassment, you know, of... You know, oh God, they know where we got the shoes from. They're not the good shoes from the sports shop, you know.
Yeah, I understand. It just feels, it makes the vulgarity of Christmas sometimes just so much when you're thinking about just want a pair of shoes.
It does. And like one thing that's kind of hit home for me in the last couple of years is the extravagance of Christmas now. And, you know, Santa bringing the iPads and iPhones worth over 1,000, which is not realistic for a lot of parents out there.
No, and also, because, you know, I work on the toy show and we have contacts in the North Pole. Santa doesn't like giving iPads and phones.
He does
occasionally, but because there might be special reasons, but he's not a big fan of that, strangely.
Yeah, because, you know, I think that a lot of kids' expectations then are just massive, and it's just not possible for a lot of people at this time of the year.
That's the truth, and he just wants kids to be happy with something small, if possible, but whatever it might be. If I could ask you then, you were 18, or 19 with a child. How bad did the drinking get for you? Was it out of control?
Yeah, it did. I had a very fairly short drinking career, Ryan. I turned into the real deal fairly quickly. So, yeah, I think, you know, after my mum passed, I'd say within 4 years, I was the real deal. And it took me till 2004, when I was 27, to go into my treatment centre.
The children would have been an issue, obviously, if you were that bad.
Yeah, it wasn't. I had the support of the children's family at the beginning, but because I just kept slipping and messing up, you know, obviously that waned. But then it came to a head in 2010 and they were actually taken from me, and it took that for me to kind of go, it's make or break now, Yvonne, you know, like, this is it, you know.
I can't imagine what it's like to have your children taken from you.
Excruciating. It's a really dark, dark period in my life, yeah.
And you were probably kind of constantly drunk and hungover and wrecked and with all of that going.
And feeling even more justified for your drinking in a mad way, because you feel, oh God, I've every right to drink now. I don't have my children, which is crazy, you know, because you're going back to the one thing that has taken the children in the first place. But of course, I wasn't educated on what it meant to be an alcoholic, or, you know, it was only later on when I got involved with a 12-step program that I started discovering all these things.
So you adored and continue to adore your children.
Absolutely.
But the circumstances, like a tsunami, were taken over.
Yeah.
So the kids were taken from you.
Yeah.
And then you find yourself going, right.
Yeah.
Enough with this.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated to know, where's the first, when you get that, when the fog starts to go, where do you say, I need to go there? Like, who was it, a person, a friend? Was it a society? Was it, you know, where did you go?
I think it was more than a feel. It was just more of a feeling, you know. I was really struggling in a dark place and I was heading down one road really dark, and it was like, you know what? It was almost like, you can have that if you want, but you have also an opportunity to do something about it if you want.
So it was your own.
Yeah, it came from within, you know, it was a feeling that came from within. And as soon as I accepted that I was ready and willing to do anything to get this sorted, within 2 weeks then I would have met with a sponsor, and I've been linked in with her ever since. And
that changed everything.
That was a big, big game changer, yeah.
I always wonder, you know, for addicts.
Yeah.
There's a strange thing, because they're in their own bubble.
Yeah.
And they feel very sorry for themselves.
Yes.
Sometimes they deserve to, because they've had a bad throw of the dice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes they don't. They're just selfish. And then families are looking at them going, Jesus, would you just please come to your senses?
I know.
And they're knocking their head off a wall. I'm talking to listeners around the country. There isn't a family who doesn't know what I'm talking about.
I know. But Ryan, it's an illness beyond
your mental.
It's an illness. We call it a threefold illness. It's an illness of the mind, the body, and it's a spiritual malady as well. Mm-hmm. And it's like the mind piece is the obsession of this addiction in your mind, you know, that you have to have it, want to have it, you will manipulate, you will do anything to get this. And once that obsession is in play, then you're off drinking. And I will not get a craving for alcohol unless I put some into my body. Mm-hmm. So when the obsession comes into play and then you take a drink, it sets off this insatiable craving for more and more and more. And you have no control over that. And then before you know it, you're onto the next bender, then the consequences of all that. And then you're waking up the next morning with a strong resolve as to what is after happening here. But you just have no answer until, you know, I partook the 12-step program, which educated me on what it meant to be an alcoholic, that it was an illness, you know, and what I needed to do to get my life back together.
And you did. You pieced it back together.
I did.
Like a Lego mountain. I love this, because you obviously went off the sauce for starters.
Yes.
Did you feel sick coming off it? Or did you have a
I needed help. You know, I needed a treatment centre twice, you know.
And twice, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, but the real work was done within the 12-step programme and a sponsor, you know, and being a part of a fellowship, you know.
Tell me about the fog disappearing from your life.
Wow. It's like, you know something has been wrong with you all your life, and then you get these answers and it's like, that's what's wrong with me.
Wow.
Yeah. And then as soon as you deal with that, it frees you up to just go and be who you're supposed to be and do what you're supposed to do.
Great. I can sense it. I actually feel liberated just looking at you and talking to you, because it's a joyful thing.
Yes, it's really a
Tell me also, if you would, about the children coming back into your arms?
Yeah, my youngest girl, she still lives with our father in Kerry, and you know, she's happy with that arrangement. Okay. It would be selfish of me now to go and try and uproot her, because she's got our school and our family and
she's
our friends, and she's happy.
Good.
You know, and you know, my eldest girl, she came back to live with me 4 years ago. And it's been great. It's just been great.
She got her mother back.
She got our mammy back.
Yeah,
yes,
she did.
Yes, and so did.
They both did.
They both did.
And gosh, what a nice result.
Yes, absolutely.
That you're not crawling the walls with booze
Thank
and
God.
Regret and everything like that. Because you're young. Can I ask you how old you are?
I'm 42.
Are you?
Yes.
Look at you, looking well, I have to say.
Thanks.
No, that's tremendous, because it just goes to show that there can be a second chance.
Yes.
A second go.
Yes.
This is like the Christmas
yes,
carol, you know.
Absolutely. It's a success story.
It's a great success story. So that's the kids' business. That's your mind and your heart business. Tell me about the education then.
Okay. So when the children left, as I said, it was a really dark time for me. I got involved with this sponsor who put me on the right track, and we done the work together. And then, you know, I was in a position, Ryan, to go back to education, and it's something that I've always wanted to do. So I did. And that I did a course in Merino College of ETAC Level 5, which opened up more doors for me then. And I wanted to go and do a degree in social care. And that's exactly what I did. And, you know, it's such a proud moment for me, you know, because it's something that I've always wanted. It's education to me is the key out of poverty. In most cases.
So true.
And, you know, St. Vincent de Paul are, you know, they're brilliant champions, you know.
Were they involved behind
absolutely.
The scenes along the way? Can I ask you how or
when
just...
I was in Merino, and obviously the children weren't with me, and my youngest girl was down in the country, and my eldest girl was over in Clondalkin, and I was, you know, I was struggling to pay maintenance for them. This was a new thing for me, and I was just really struggling, and I felt like thrown in the towel so many times, because how hard it is to try and see the kids and work and go to college and have assignments and try and keep linked in with your 12-step program as well. I think it's a lot of balls to have up in the air, and financially at times I thought I just wasn't going to be able to do it. But then linking in with St. Vincent de Paul and the support and the love even from the volunteers that I felt was outstanding. Like,
it's just kindness.
Kindness, absolutely. And genuinely these people cared, and they were championing me on through college, and you know, really want me to do me best.
You're a nerd.
I'm not a nerd.
You are, and you need to take that as a compliment, because you loved going back to school.
Yes.
And you loved sitting in the classroom. Didn't you? I can tell looking at you.
Okay.
And you loved taking notes and doing assignments. And, you know, you probably loved stationery as well and getting
yes,
new pens.
Yes, I do.
And, I got that impression.
Yeah.
So this, you're just a natural born, you know, nerd. So for you to be able to go back and to celebrate it with the help of the Vincent de Paul, and then to come into us and tell your story this morning, to encourage people to feel no shame.
No shame.
To encourage people who are in a position to donate, get busy donating.
Please do.
Buy less tat and put the money somewhere correct.
Yeah.
And give people that lift up.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe life now for you?
Life is beyond my wildest dreams now, Ryan. I never thought 10 years ago I'd be sitting here speaking to you, Ryan Turbidy.
Well, that cuts both ways.
And in a great job with my children healthy and happy, and being in a position now where, you know, I can do whatever I can to help out as well. So,
love it.
Yeah.
Wonderful interview and a powerful woman, says
Thank
Jane. That's the listeners from Jane says, and another says, this lady has such a powerful outlook. I've been on that road, and I wish her the very best in life, and not just for Christmas.
Oh, thanks very much,
Jane.
Yeah,
and that's just a flavour of what people are saying about you this morning. And not an easy thing to come in and to bear your soul like that, but I think it will have done a few things. One, for people in addiction,
mm-hmm.
People feeling poverty, feeling pressure, will feel less problematic mm-hmm. about getting onto the visit to Paul and saying, listen, bit stuck here.
Mm-hmm.
But also, hopefully, counting on the kindness of strangers, particularly people who might have disposable income, who they can feel that they can actually do something good with it, would be lovely. Orla's just been on to say, what a joy to listen to this wonderful woman. She's walked a long, hard road and is an inspiration to hear this morning. So
That's
take
great.
That in your sails. us if you would. Yvonne, it's been a pleasure to see you.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
And lots of love to you and your children and your extended family this
Christmas. Thank you very much, Ryan.
Okay,
same to you.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate that. And thanks to our friends also, svp.ie. You know where to go if you can. It's 9:45.